sir. Thank you.
Thank you. Dear friends, thank you for inviting me to speak here, where the idea of America was summoned into reality in an English essay that considers the truth of universal human freedom to be self-evident, where the Liberty Bell bears the words of the Psalm of King David, evoking cosmic joy in a city with a classical Greek name meaning fraternal love. Philadelphia embodies one facet of our nation, the visionary hope of a peaceful commonwealth populated by citizens heeding the quiet inner voice. Boston reflects another facet, that of the martial valor needed to defend that dream. I live three blocks from the Cambridge Village Common where General Washington mustered his patriots, and a short subway ride from the site of the battle at Bunker Hill, and a score of miles from Concord's rude bridge that arched the flood where the embattled farmers stood and fired the shot heard round the world. William Lloyd Garrison pronounced his Jeremiad against slavery at the Park Street Church in Boston. Every train in that city traveling in that direction is considered inbound. In between Philadelphia and Boston is my hometown and Walt Whitman's New York, the place where Hart Crane mused about the Brooklyn Bridge and Isaac Bashevis Singer performed his literary alchemy in an Upper West Side cafeteria. New York symbolizes, for all the planet, the fulfillment of the American project, the immigrant melting pot, the gorgeous mosaic, the place where generations have come not to get a good night's sleep in history's nightmare, as Delmer Schwartz grumbled, but to spend the night clubbing, ordering pizza, and looking at the bright lights of Manhattan. The third facet, the brightest. If there is any holy land on earth, this is it, the northeastern seaboard of the United States, our home. So I'm honored to be here, though this is a lecture I'd rather there were no need to give. I'd rather be talking about Armenian mythology or Pushkin's poems. But the 19th century Russian writer Nekrasov's admonition, one need not be a poet, but one is obliged to be a citizen, is truer now than it ever was. This country, America, is at war with an Islamic fascism that has revived the rhetoric of the Nazis, which shares their aims and disdains to conceal them. The Jewish people and the State of Israel are not the cause of this war any more than the canary in a coal mine is the cause of asphyxiation of the miners by poison gas. It is in the nature of fascists, totalitarians, and demagogues to scapegoat a people whose very longevity mocks pompous plans for a thousand-year Reich, or a worldwide revolution, or, now, a global Islamic caliphate. Their retrograde and repressive vision cannot abide the presence of a cosmopolitan culture that has thrived for three millennia, at least, on the free exchange of goods and ideas and the cultivation of individual conscience and human rights. Anti-Semitism is not reason to be reckoned with, but the very essence of unreason, a stance of opposition to reason. So to search within ourselves for a reason for its recrudescence means to misunderstand its essence and to accord its proponents a dignity that they do not deserve. Yet this war is still, in part, a mental fight, not least because the enemy is on our university campuses, on the airwaves, seeking to weaken by disinformation our resolve and to present our foes as friends and our friends as foes. The battle at home is one of ideas, and our weapons are words. Make no mistake, it is no less deadly a war, and if we lose this battle of it, we'll lose the wider war. I shall present this discussion in three parts. First, I will mention something of my own experience as an academic dealing with anti-Semitism and Israel bashing on American campuses. Then I will address an article entitled The Israel Lobby, co-authored by Stephen Walt and published in the London Review of Books in March 2006. It is a distasteful thing to read, But Professor Walt was dean of Harvard's own Kennedy School of Government and still teaches there. So I must echo Prospero in Shakespeare's Tempest, who says of the monstrous villain Caliban, "This thing of darkness, I acknowledge mine." The third part will be the hardest, because I'm a New Yorker and because today happens to be the day before the 11th of September. Two things happened to Near Eastern studies in the late 20th century. The first was a sequence of political events: the Islamic Revolution in Iran, the war against the Soviets in Afghanistan, and the subsequent collapse of the communist system. Post hoc ergo propter hoc. Since one thing happened first, it has to have been the cause of what happened next, is not a logical fallacy in this instance. This chain of events is, to a large degree, causal. Radical Islam, perceived as an anti-capitalist movement offering the hope of revolutionary change to the oppressed peoples of the world, filled the vacuum that was left by the failure worldwide of Marxism. The second thing that happened was that resurgent Islam acquired an academic apostle in liberal academia, the late Professor Edward Said of Columbia University. Said, a Palestinian by background, a professor of comparative literature with no academic credentials in the Near Eastern field, published his best-known and best-selling book, Orientalism, a year before the Iranian Islamic Revolution. He argued that modern Western scholarship on the Middle East served the interests of European colonial powers and was colored by prejudice. Consequently, it demonized and infantilized the Muslims in general and Arabs in particular. Professor Said employed his thesis to great polemical benefit, lending a veneer of academic respectability to Palestinian terrorism. Through the 1980s, I was a junior professor of Armenian and then of ancient Iranian at Columbia University. Two of my courses were listed among the top 10 in the course guide. One of these enjoyed the largest registration at the whole university. Well, two books and 47 articles later, I was denied tenure there. Our department chair, a Lebanese who held weekly fireside chats during the first Gulf War, whose singular purpose was to deny the viability of Israel, had told me some years before the assassination of the Egyptian president Anwar Sadat, who had offered Israel a peace treaty, was the condign punishment of a traitor. In recent years, a Columbia undergrad has testified that this same scholar told her she could not be a Semite because she has green eyes. Two senior professors in my department explained that I could not expect, as a Jew, to be kept as a tenured member of the Middle East Department. Columbia's Jewish president, its Jewish undergraduate dean, who is a great friend of Said's, its Jewish professor of Hebrew literature, its numerous Jewish alumni, and the largest Jewish community in the world, just outside the gates, were indifferent to this case of job discrimination. I was offered a post at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem and moved to Israel, leaving my life partner and my home, and settling down with my intrepid cat and whirring laptop in a small dark apartment below street level in the Jerusalem neighborhood of Bayit Vegan. My apartment flooded whenever it rained, but I was in a place where I was welcome. One day, as I munched my falafel in the university cafeteria, I read an article by Edward Said in some travel magazine about American academics who waltz, this was his word, he was also a music critic, don't you know, to Israel on their sabbaticals. Well, on my birthday, I really did waltz. I took my cat in my arms and we waltzed around our little apartment in Bayit Vegan, because we were in a place where I was treated as a colleague and a human being. A few days after that, I was invited to take up the professorial chair I now hold at Harvard, and at the end of the year, I moved back to this country. So I learned on my own skin what Israel is about in a way few American Jews, happily, have ever had to do. It is a refuge for Jews whose lives elsewhere have been dismembered and shattered by anti-Semitism, while people look on in indifference. In my experience, Israel is a country of hard-working people who've survived the bitterness of loss and who regard the rest of the world sometimes with understandable wariness, but more often with a cheerful goodwill that would defy common sense if it did not arise from a deep and confident self-reliance. If Muslims stopped defaming and attacking Israel, they would probably find friends there practicing a faith not all that different from the better aspects of their own. How many Jews have won Nobel Prizes, and how many more would there be if Israel's budget could go to science rather than defense? Israel saved my life. Yet in a way, I'm now living on borrowed time. For had I not come back here to Harvard, had I stayed in Jerusalem, it's likely I should have been killed by what the BBC chooses to call Palestinian militants. Both buses I took to campus, number 20 and number 21 Aleph, as well as at least one bus stop in my neighborhood, the Sinatra cafeteria on Haratzofim, Mount Scopus, where I met friends and pupils most days for lunch, a few familiar falafel stands downtown on King George Street, the Machane Yehuda market, where my friend David Yerushalmi and I rendezvoused every Thursday night to eat Kurdish shish kebab, and Cafe Akara on Rehov Ben Yehuda, where I sat in the sun, drank coffee, and read the Jerusalem Post most every Friday morning, have all been bombed by suicide bombers at least once since I left, sometimes twice. One of my students was sitting next to a 19-year-old girl. A bomb went off, and when he recovered, he saw pieces of her around him. Militants did this. Militants. Several Protestant churches here and in Britain call for divestment from Caterpillar Incorporated because Israel, a country without the death penalty, uses bulldozers to knock down the houses of the suicide bombers as some kind of a deterrent, and these bombers are celebrated throughout the Islamic world as martyrs. Martyr is a Greek word meaning witness. Arabic shahid is its equivalent. Witness to what? That God is very great? So in Israel I acquired new compatriots of an alternative future. The dead passengers on the Eged bus, the dead boys and girls eating their lunch, the dead women buying fruits and vegetables for their families. In the words of Vladimir Nabokov, these are the murdered, forgotten, unrevenged, incorrupt, and immortal ones. And I returned here to teach my subject Armenian. And I must now speak, for you remember, I began discussing Edward Said, I must now speak of other murdered people, likewise condemned to oblivion in the Near East. For as you probably know, as anyone who has ever met an Armenian knows, and Philadelphia has a large Armenian community, the central fact of existence for that ancient Christian people of the Near East is the genocide that began in the 1890s in Ottoman Turkey and ended soon after the conclusion of the First World War. The Ottoman state, which was also the seat of the caliphate until the caliphate was abolished in 1924, systematically murdered its Armenian population in a campaign that was called at the time a jihad. The word genocide didn't exist until the 1940s. The Ottoman government advertised what was being done to the Armenians as a jihad, a Muslim holy war. Down to the mid-19th century, the Ottomans, who had a few centuries before besieged the gates of Vienna, still ruled most of the Arabic-speaking Middle East and the Balkans. Turkey, called the sick man of Europe, was still a mighty empire, the main political player in the region in the 19th century, the titular head of most of world Islam, all of Sunni Islam, and an oppressor of millions and millions of Greek, Serbian, Bulgarian, Albanian, and Romanian Christian subjects. Muslim Turkey was not a colonized victim. Muslim Turkey embodied the Islamic Near East in the 19th century. It was not a colonized victim, but a repressive colonial world power. When the Armenian massacres began in 1896, and then they crested again in 1915, they were front page news all over the world. And the modern human rights movement, as we know it, began with grassroots groups formed in Boston and New York to save the Armenians. These included many prominent American Jews. And the loudest voice against the massacres was the Jewish American ambassador to Ottoman Turkey, Morgenthau. Now let's return to Said's Orientalism. Do you remember the thesis that I summarized? Western scholars presented Islam, he says, in a negative way in order to justify the colonization by their imperialist states of essentially defenseless Arab lands. And this has become the controlling narrative of Near Eastern studies on almost every American campus. And Israel is seen as the spearhead of this Western imperialism. This is the great fallacy, a fallacy that, to my knowledge, has never been brought forth in public. Said neglected to mention that the Arabs were not the players in the Islamic world in the 19th century. Their rulers, the Ottoman Turks, the seat of the caliphate that Osama bin Laden wants to restore, they were. And the rulers of the caliphate were not just extremely powerful, they used genocide as state policy and employed the terminology of Islam to justify that policy during the First World War. Now that did get Islam some bad press. But there is not a word in the book Orientalism about the persecution of the Armenians that culminated in the genocide. The argument of the book rests, that is, on a reading of modern Middle Eastern history that omits so large and essential a proportion of the relevant facts as to be fiction. A professorial chair at Columbia has been named after the author of this work of mendacious pseudo-scholarship following his death, and Said's framed portrait hangs over the cash desk at Labyrinth Bookstore on Morningside Heights. The legacy of Edward Said is celebrated at annual conferences, and collections of interviews, occasional pieces, and musings continue to be published almost every year. This man, whose principal work is a falsification of the history of the Near East in the 19th and early 20th centuries, has become the centerpiece of American scholarship on the subject. So, at the beginning of the 21st century, the pro-communist sentiment of liberal academia in the United States had been replaced by a general sympathy for the Arabs as post-colonial revolutionaries, together with an easy antipathy towards Israel. Where previously the ends had been seen to justify the means by pro-Stalinist academics, the end being an egalitarian utopia and the means to achieve it being state repression and extreme violence, now the means employed by the PLO, Hamas, Hezbollah, and so on, were to be justified not by their ends anymore, because who in his right mind wants a caliphate, but by their causes. And these causes were none other than those delineated in the pseudo-scholarship of Said's Orientalism, with its mythology of an innocent and passive Muslim polity, a third world community, raped by imperialists and colonized by Zionists. It is as well that the apologists of Islam did not justify the means by invoking the ends in any case, because not even the most irresponsible armchair radical in Cambridge, Berkeley, or on the Upper West Side really wants to live in a caliphate run by Sharia law as meted out by the Taliban or by Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, the maniac who runs Iran at the moment. What had once been the American left on campus, in other words, had flipped 180 degrees, promoting a program of Jew hatred and social regression of the kind that the extreme right once favored in the 1930s. Only the dislike of American values and a romantic espousal of violence by people who weren't there living reading books were the same. So while Edward Said was marking the last days of his brilliant career on this earth with such inspirational gestures as throwing rocks at the soldiers guarding the Israeli border with Lebanon, I've moved to Harvard to teach Armenian. Our Near East department tends towards a focus on antiquity rather than contemporary issues. Most of our grad students deal with biblical and ancient Mesopotamian studies, so we have been spared the worst of the political polarization on other campuses that David Horowitz describes in his recent book, my review of which you can read on frontpagemag.com if you wish. However, Harvard is not without its problems. An Iraqi lecturer in Arabic who wrote in the foreword supporting the American overthrow of Saddam Hussein and who condemned suicide bombers did not have his contract renewed 2 years ago. The ostensible cause was the quality of his teaching, although the day he was fired, he had just received a teaching award from the university. President Larry Summers, as you probably... Oh, by the way, I circulated that teaching award and asked for a vote to reinstate the man. My chairman simply said, no, we've already made our decision, and tore it up. President Larry Summers, as you probably know, decried a petition for Harvard and MIT to divest from companies doing business with Israel as anti-Semitic in effect, if not in intent. This petition was circulated during the second Intifada in 2002, during a month when Israeli grandmothers with their grandchildren were being blown up in hotels at Seder's, and Israel was being accused of a massacre in the city of Jenin in the West Bank that it turned out it never committed. That's the background. Summers had been hired by Harvard to shake things up, to make changes in the curriculum and the governance of the university. But once he did, or tried to do, these things, he became the target of a whispering campaign in which it was his personal appearance and deportment, as much as his views, that were caricatured and vilified. People talked about how Larry was overweight, how he ate greedily and dribbled grease on his tie, about how he sweated, about how he was chauffeured around in a shiny black limousine. This is the composite stereotype of the physically gross, sensual, rich Jew, so familiar to anyone who has studied the anti-Semitic cartoons of the Nazi era or the present-day Muslim world. And hadn't Professor Cornel West, who decamped in high dudgeon to Princeton to teach African-American studies there, after Summers had the audacity to ask whether he was doing any scholarly writing for his $250,000 salary, called him the Ariel Sharon of Harvard. So the trustees of the university succumbed to the carefully crafted fiction that Larry Summers was unpopular. In fact, only a minority of the voting members of our Faculty of Arts and Sciences, which is only one of several faculties of the university, voted no confidence in him. And they forced his resignation before his supporters could mount a defense and dispel the cloud of disinformation. And thus, went, our Jewish president, who wasn't ashamed to be a Jew and didn't parade the usual political correctness expected of university presidents. Just a few weeks after Summers' forced resignation, on March 23rd of this year, Professor Stephen Wolt, who was then Dean of Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, published together with John Mearsheimer of the University of Chicago, in the London Review of Books, an article entitled The Israel Lobby, which has since earned accolades from the neo-Nazi politician David Duke down south and from Islamists the world over. It was published also and subsequently withdrawn from the Kennedy School's own website. The overall thesis of the piece is that a small cabal of American Jews, called neoconservatives, has manipulated the entire foreign policy of this country. The centerpiece of this policy, which is directly at odds, they say, with America's national interests, is uncritical support of Israel. That country is portrayed as though its entire raison d'etre, its reason for existing, were to wage aggressive wars against innocent and defenseless Arab neighbors, characterized as David by the authors, as opposed to the Israel Goliath. 23 Davids controlling the world's oil, and one Goliath, a little smaller than New Jersey without any oil. Anyway, innocent, defenseless Arab neighbors, and thereby imperil the peace and security of the human race. This is what Israel's about, making it difficult for the human race to survive. The authors suggest that Jews claim, and this is the word they use, special treatment because of unspecified, quote, past crimes against them. But Israel's own crimes against the Palestinians, as they call them, even the score, as it were. So whatever Israel has done to the Palestinians is equivalent to the Holocaust and everything else that's ever happened in Jewish history, whether it's medieval persecution in Europe or in the Islamic world or anywhere else. Their conclusion: the United States should abandon its so-called moral reasons for supporting Israel and adopt what they call an even-handed policy in the Near East. A full refutation of this article would require considerably more space than the text itself, and others have done this. However, a few detailed comments are worth offering here. The authors suggest that support for Israel has, quote, inflamed Arab and Islamic opinion, unquote, against this country. That is, were Israel to be abandoned, the Muslim countries would be America's friends and the world would be a safer place. They also suggest that the present problems we've had with terrorism, including 9/11, come directly from our support to Israel. Would such newfound friends, assuming that the argument is right, would such newfound friends be particularly useful to us, useful to the United States? To be hard-headed to start with. The Arab countries, despite their oil wealth, manage collectively to present annual economic figures inferior to those of laid-back sunny Spain. Fewer books are translated every year into Arabic, which is spoken by about 100 million people, than into modern Greek, which is spoken about by about 10 million, most of whom read foreign languages anyhow. How many Muslim countries have produced in the last century individuals who've won Nobel Prizes in the arts and sciences, registered patents, or contributed to the world's literature, art, music, and philosophy, by comparison to the tiny Jewish people? When the Palestinian Authority elected Hamas, the first thing they complained about was being cut from the welfare rolls of the United States and the European Union. It never seems to occur to the Palestinians, or to Lebanon at the moment, to earn a living when deprived of income because of wars that they begin. Does the U.S. need 23 more such countries taking our handouts? Isn't Egypt enough? Would these friends, if not useful, be desirable? Do we want to have such friends? Mearsheimer and Wolt are particularly outraged by the hostility shown by the Israel lobby, which seems to include anybody not in agreement with them. They give all sorts of lists. towards Saddam Hussein's Iraq, Syria under the Ba'ath dictatorship, and the regime of President Ahmadinejad. Let's remember what these potential friends are capable of doing. Saddam Hussein, before we liberated Iraq, participated in the massacre of Iraqi Kurds. I know this firsthand because I know Kurdish, and I've had Kurdish friends since I was a grad student, so I knew what was going on in Halabja when it was happening. And one of my friends, by the way, was missing half his face. It was just a mass of scar tissue because he'd been shot by Saddam's secret police for speaking Kurdish on the campus of Baghdad University. That's the guy we overthrew. What did we do wrong in overthrowing Saddam Hussein? Do we want that sort of a friend? Syria. In 1983, Hafez al-Assad, Bashir's dad, massacred about 30,000 inhabitants of the Syrian city of Hama. It's an ancient city, and what he did was to bombard the center city with artillery because he didn't like the spread of Islamist parties in Syria. Then there's Ahmadinejad. His most recent proposal is to expel non-Islamist professors from Tehran University and, as he puts it, to obliterate Iran's 150-year-old encounter with modernity. Hezbollah, which is neither more nor less than an extension of the Iranian government, murdered 241 service personnel of the United States Marine Corps as they slept. These men were in Lebanon to keep the peace. At the end of a civil war and a subsequent international conflict that had been started by the PLO and other Palestinian terrorist groups funded by Syria, amongst others, and the Soviet Union. Syria supplies arms and logistical support to Hezbollah as well in an effort to destroy Lebanese sovereignty. Should one regret that these regimes are not our friends? Would they make reliable friends for the United States were we to abandon Israel and embrace them instead? As an American, I do not want to consort with the cold-blooded murderers of American soldiers. Any man who does, I consider a traitor. A traitor. Does the word treason have a meaning? If it does, then that's it. If you apologize for those who blow up American peacekeepers in their sleep, then you're a traitor to this country. Somebody has to say that to Mearsheimer and Walt, that this is treason. There is no reason, by contrast, for Americans to apologize shamefacedly to anybody in Europe or elsewhere for our friendship with Israel. Jews and Israelis are not known for blowing up school buses, cafeterias, Spanish suburban trains, and trains of the London Underground. Jews tend not to hijack civilian planes and then fly them into office buildings packed with men and women starting their working day. Huh? Israelis do not kidnap journalists, businessmen, and workers and slit their throats before video cameras. It is Arabs and Muslims who have been doing these things. It's not racist to say this. It's a description. By the way, being Muslim is not membership in a race. And instead of real soul-searching and contrition, all we tend to get from the mainstream Islamic organizations and from the principal imams is arrogant self-justification and lying, and the usual argument of the causes justifying the means, that no matter what atrocity is committed, it's understandable, if not excusable, because of Israel. This is the fallacy of the causes justifying the means, the sort of flip side of the ends justifying the means that I spoke about a little earlier. The myth of even-handedness, compounded by the academic fantasy that there is no truth and untruth, just competing discourses, is not just a way of numbing human beings to the hard fact that there is good and evil in life. It ends up calling good evil and evil good. I do not want to have as allies countries to whom the concepts of human rights, intellectual freedom, the separation of church and state, an independent judiciary, and democratically elected leadership are not just alien but inimical, people who stone gays to death. The gay movement in the United States tends to boycott Israeli gay marches. I don't know if you noticed this. There was supposed to be a meeting of Israeli Jewish and Arab gay people in Jerusalem this summer. In spite of the war, it still went ahead. Yeah? But a lot of the Boston gay organizations boycotted it out of solidarity with the Palestinians and with Hezbollah, even though Arab gays from the West Bank tend to flood into Israel because it's a capital offense to be gay now in the Palestinian Authority, thanks to Hamas's imposition of Sharia. Yeah? Never mind Iran. But still, this is the power of political correctness and fictions that have become deeply inculcated on American campuses. And it's hip to believe these fictions. And professors want their students to think that they're hip too, so it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. Everyone goes around and around trying to be more and more fashionable to each other. People who stone gays to death, who routinely practice beheading and flogging, who force women to undergo clitoral circumcision, make them wear veils, people who promote African slavery, and who are waging genocidal war in Darfur. I don't want to be liked by Israel's enemies. As an American, I don't want to be liked by them, since their approbation would diminish my own character. And I don't think their friendship would be of any value, save perhaps in the short term, and then only to the genteel old guard of State Department Arabist types and their friends in big oil. The America that Mearsheimer and Wolf would foist upon us is a repugnant one. Its interests would be defined not by the votes of the majority or by free political discourse, as now, but by the bigoted old guard Ivy elite who brought us the numerous clauses, the gentleman's agreement, and the culture of segregation. These are the guys who call themselves the old conservatives. It would be an America cynically contemptuous of the legacy of the Nazi Holocaust, stigmatizing Israel for imaginary or exaggerated offenses, and callously ignoring the real enormities occurring constantly in the benighted Muslim world, enormities that are a detriment to the life of the people who live in that world. In fact, Mearsheimer's and Wolf's vision resembles Philip Roth's nightmare in his recent novel, The Plot Against America, of a country ruled at the outbreak of World War II by Charles Lindbergh instead of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Would the abandonment of Israel earn America the friendship of our present adversaries? In any case, I doubt it. And again, the particular experience I have of a specialist in Armenian affairs may afford unexpected insights here. In 1948, an Armenian-American immigrant named Avadis Derunyan went to Cairo to write a book about the Arab struggle against the fledgling Jewish state. As a boy in Upper Manhattan, my neighborhood, Derunyan had witnessed the murder by fascists in his own community, an Armenian group called the Dashnaktsutyun, of the Archbishop of the Armenian Church in America, Revon Turian, while the latter was celebrating the Christmas Mass in Holy Cross Church. They grabbed him while he was in his vestments and disemboweled him in front of his community. A few years later, using the pseudonym John Roy Carlson, Avadis infiltrated and exposed the anti-Semitic America Firsters and other pro-Nazi movements in the U.S. His work led to the formation of a congressional committee of investigation, to the arrests of pro-Nazi conspirators in this country, and his book Undercover became a wartime bestseller. So after the war, Derunyan went back undercover tracking escaped Nazi war criminals to the Near East, where they had made common cause with Muslim extremist groups in Palestine, Egypt, and Syria. These groups had supported the Axis side during the war, and they were also joined by British anti-Semites. Mearsheimer and Walt in their articles say that Israel was extremely powerful in 1948, but the fact is it was actually fighting elements of the British Army controlled by British anti-Semites who were helping Jordan, the Arab Legion in Jordan. But they also depict the 1948 war as a series of what they call fresh crimes against the Palestinians, whom they call the largely innocent third party, as though the Palestinians weren't even involved in the 48 war. So, Derunyan, upon his return to the U.S., published a book, From Cairo to Damascus is the title, which was published in New York by Knopf in 1950. Very respectable publisher, but it came right at the beginning of the McCarthy witch hunts. And Derunyan was portrayed by the Dashnaks as pro-communist, so the book didn't sell too well. In the book, Derunyan predicted that the ideology of Islamic fundamentalism was neither more nor less than a new incarnation, a metamorphosis of fascism. He also said that in his view, it was likely that Islamic fundamentalism, or Islamofascism, as our president correctly terms it, would outlive communism and present a far more serious threat to America and to human freedom in general within a few decades than the Soviet Union ever could. An interesting prediction. As for Israel, which he visited when it was just born, Derunyan saw it as a generally good society, and it became the model for his dream of a future democratic Armenia. So a man whose family had witnessed the first genocide of the 20th century, which was called a jihad by its perpetrators, and who had exposed fascism in the new country he loved, then traveled to the Near East to see the reincarnation of fascism as Islamic fundamentalism, and then he returned to the U.S. to warn us. You're aware of the tactic of the big lie. Hitler determined to exterminate the Jews and to conquer the world, so he accused the Jews of threatening the existence of Germany and of plotting to plunge the world into war. When he carried out his plan, his sympathizers in this country predictably accused the Jews of dragging America into a war that we didn't need to fight. But before that, well-intentioned pacifists had decried the injustices Germany had suffered under the Versailles Treaty that ended the First World War. Now, why is Hitler so bad? Well, these are the causes. They don't excuse them, but they explain them. Let's try to understand him. Conflict must be prevented, they argued, therefore, by making territorial concessions. Concessions to Hitler. Those were the words used then, concessions. The Rhineland, the Saar, the city of Danzig. But these capitulations encouraged him. So, come back. Under pressure to make concessions, Israel withdraws from southern Lebanon. Hezbollah takes over. Under pressure again, Israel withdraws from Gaza. The Palestinians elect Hamas. What's next? The city built by the Jewish kings David and Solomon, where the Jew Jesus Christ walked, perhaps. I refer to what the BBC refers to as Arab East Jerusalem. But Mearsheimer and Wolf refer to the entirety of Israel as Arab land. So let's keep it up. Let's leave all Arab land. Make more and more concessions. Eventually, like the Armenians, whom the Turks drove into the sea, literally, at Smyrna in 1922, the Israelis left alive will have to try to swim to Cyprus. Allied warships, British, French, American, off the coast of Turkey, played their gramophones loud on deck to drown out the screams of the drowning Greeks and Armenians who were being pushed into the sea, and poured boiling water on the Armenians who tried to climb aboard those ships. A few of them were saved by Greek fishermen who were evidently were ignorant of what passed for even-handedness and political correctness in the year of grace 1922. and the State Department's minions of those days had counseled abandonment of the Armenians. Why should we alienate the Islamic world, and Turkey in particular, by espousing the cause of a small people who, they said, in dispatches to Washington from Constantinople, the Ottoman capital and then the early Turkish Republic capital, were like the Jews anyhow. This was something that didn't favor the Armenians. Why alienate Turkey? The Waltz and the Mearsheimers of the 1920s had their way. If they have their way again, Israel could very likely be abandoned and weakened. Israel is a liability, write Mearsheimer and Waltz, in the war on terror. Czechoslovakia was a liability in 1938 to Hitler, so Britain and France delivered it. And before we leave the example of a hapless Czechoslovakia, I'd like to note that Mearsheimer and Waltz in their article complain that during the Cold War, Israel's, quote, military prowess forced Moscow to spend more on backing its own client states, unquote. Yeah? Because Israel was strong, the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics was forced to spend more money. But Israel, remember, in its pre-1967 borders, no West Bank, no United Jerusalem, no Gaza, no Golan, kept asking to make peace treaties with the Arabs, and it was always refused. President Nasser of Egypt had amassed by 1967 a tremendous Soviet arsenal. He lined up his tanks in Sinai. Some of you remember this. Those of you who are too young should read about it. And promised to drive the Jews into the sea. There were Arab crowds in front of the UN in New York chanting, "No more Israel." I remember this. I saw it with my own eyes. And I grew up in a family of Holocaust survivors who were saying, "It's happening again." Syria rained Russian-made missiles on northern Israel from the Golan, but Israel committed the unpardonable offense of successfully defending itself, not once but twice, 1967 and again in 1973. This is how it forced the peace-loving Leonid Brezhnev, who invaded Czechoslovakia in 1968 to crush its democracy, exactly 30 years after the Munich Agreement, to spend so much money on weapons. But in Mearsheimer and Waltz's construction, and that of others in the academic world, I'm only focusing on them because Waltz is my colleague, a country the size of New Jersey with a population half that of New York forced a totalitarian empire occupying one-sixth of the land surface of the planet, armed to the teeth, to make military expenditures. Israel has truly supernatural powers. Pardon me for living. Were it not for Israel, the Warsaw Pact would have been dispensing daisies to the Czechs in Prague, to the Poles, and then to the Afghans later on. One appreciates the writer's solicitude towards our chief Cold War adversary, who isn't even around anymore, whilst wondering how such concern fits their declared purpose of defining America's interests. If anything, it seems to me that Waltz and Mearsheimer are more solicitous of the interests of the former Soviet Union long after its demise. Let me restate the metaphor. Miners go down to work with a canary in a cage because it succumbs to poison gas before people do. When it gets sick, though, nobody blames it as the cause of the deadly vapors. Nor does anybody propose to kill the little bird so that lots of great big people can be saved. Fascism is the poison, the Jews are the canary, the world's free people are the coal miners. It's as senseless to blame the Jews, who have always been the first and best scapegoats for the recrudescence of fascism today, as it would be to kill the canary. If 9/11 happened in part because we're friends of Israel, then the character of that act of murder should be an indication of why a country like America is a friend of Israel and should stand by it. Mearsheimer, I have more. Mearsheimer and Waltz suggest the Israel lobby has what they call a stranglehold on Congress, that it prevents critical discussion of Israel in the media, like NPR, for instance, which never criticizes Israel, and that it relies on the high turnout rate of American Jews who vote. Shame on the Jews for exercising the right to vote. Shame on us for thinking that we're Americans and can have our own ideas about what the national interest is, other than that of Gentile professors at Harvard. We're not guests here, any more than Mearsheimer, Walt, or Pat Buchanan are. America's interests are determined by a consensus, not by a standard set by the Mayflower. Our government is chosen in free elections. The Israel lobby doesn't elect it. America supports Israel because most Americans do. Americans are not fools. We're not manipulated. We can make up our own minds. We have not been deluded, as they suggest, by a conspiracy. We can glean information from Fox News or NPR, God help us, from Haaretz, Le Monde, and anything else online, and 10,000 blogs. Mearsheimer and Walt are not content to portray American electoral support for Israel as the result of a Jewish conspiracy. They further claim that the Israel lobby want, quote, the U.S. to do most of the fighting and dying in the Middle East to protect Israel's interests. This is a restatement of the ancient lie that the Jews are cowardly and unmanly, both pitifully weak and monstrously manipulatively powerful at the same time, and that we use others to fight our battles. It's a libel. No foreign soldier has ever shed a drop of blood to defend the state of Israel, nor has any ever been asked to do so. Israel lets Saddam Hussein fire Scud missiles onto civilian targets with impunity in the first Gulf War, while the Palestinians danced on the rooftops chanting Allahu Akbar, and they were to dance on 9/11 in Ramallah too. It did not respond to these attacks because George Bush's dad asked it not to. But then Mearsheimer and Wolf parlay Israeli popular support for the overthrow of Saddam into the insinuation that the war was fought on Israel's behalf. They, of course, downplay the danger posed by the takeover of Kuwait that was the cause of the war, and that there were some other people who wanted Saddam overthrown. Iran, the Saudis, the Iraqi Kurds, the Iraqi Shias, the Kuwaitis, everyone basically except the Revolutionary Guard in Iraq. If Israel was pulling the strings, then why did the U.S. stop the advance on Baghdad? Because it wasn't Israel pulling the strings. It was our Arab allies pulling the strings who wanted it that way. And that's why for over a decade, Saddam remained in power and we continued to have problems with Iraq. That's what happens when you have Arab allies. They were the ones who were manipulative. Israel wasn't. The historical record is so consistently the opposite of what Mearsheimer and Walt say it is, that their article is at least a superb specimen of how not to do scholarship. It is ultimately a matter of indifference what a person thinks of Jews or of Israel. Anti-Semitism is to be fought, not understood. However, it is fair to insist that educators and scholars adhere to a standard of honesty. If they are dishonest, then it is also fair for alumni and others to withhold contributions from the academic institutions that employ them, and for those of us who have children studying at Harvard to remind them that there are many courses on politics to choose from besides Stephen Walt's. Walt should be challenged strenuously, relentlessly, and within the bounds of the discourse of a civil society, and their publications and scholarly journals should be checked for the facts. None of this violates any principle of academic freedom, as they claim it does. But denying tenure to a colleague because he's a Jew, or firing a Muslim Iraqi teacher of Arabic because he supports Israel and opposes suicide terrorism, is a violation of academic freedom. And to cloak one in the language of civility at that point is an abuse of the concept. To impugn the loyalties of Jewish Americans and to suggest that this small minority manipulates the whole country with the aim of shedding our soldiers' blood to further interests inimical to America's is not only a perversion of the intellect, It is an offense. When Henry David Thoreau was in jail for civil disobedience, and his friend Emerson, peering through the bars, asked, "What are you doing in there?" he retorted, "No, what are you doing out there?" The question is not why I choose to speak out the way I am right now. The question is why so many Jewish American students and teachers are so complacent that they don't. I'd like to speak, finally, about a day, the third and last part, getting your money's worth, at least, I guess. Finally, about a day that's on our minds because its fifth anniversary comes tomorrow. I can't think of better people to remember it with than you all. The meaning of the events of 9/11 has been corrupted by apologists of hatred, and that has disfigured the very ability to mourn, which should be our right as Americans. I kept a journal of that time. An essay based on it was published by a student arts magazine at Cambridge in Britain a year later. Memory in Jewish tradition is a form of sanctification. I want to close by reading part of this essay so that together, not just as a group gathered to talk about current affairs, but as a holy community, we may celebrate together our love for this country of ours, founded on no one faith or ethnicity, but on the idea of freedom, a freedom that has to be defended, a country that men and women from every corner of the world call our home. It's called the war. Part one is the peaceful world. I spent most of Monday, September 10th, 2001, finishing a paper for a conference. Sunday, a former student had come by for supper. Monday, my colleague, the Harvard Persian scholar Wheeler, came for dinner with yet another student. I didn't go out Monday, wanted to get the paper done and buy the new Bob Dylan album that was due out on the 11th as a reward for diligence. So, still in my flip-flops, I walked Wheeler home. It began to rain and he invited me up for a nightcap. Walking back on the deserted Cambridge streets, I wondered to myself what the killing of the Afghan leader Ahmed Shah Massoud by two Arabs that day might mean. But it was far away. Not that I hadn't been thinking about it. Two Tuesdays before, Bob, the man who cleans my place monthly, had been keeping me company over morning coffee, and I said to him I thought the only reason Muslim terrorists had not crashed a plane into midtown Manhattan was that they feared our response. I thought this was coming. And I believe they did fear our response, so I was really no more afraid than anyone else. On the night of the 10th, I got home and copied out something for an article. Term was about to start. Course books were ready. My cat seemed to have a bit of a cold, but it was getting better, and she and I fell into a pleasant sleep in a peaceful world. The clock radio went on at 9. The BBC's reporter, with a surprised, puzzled tone, was saying a small plane seemed to have had an accident with one of the towers of the World Trade Center. This felt wrong, so I rang my mom in New York and told her this was no accident and she must not get on the subway, must not go to work. Just as my father shouted in the background that we should both stop our paranoid over-dramatizing, their TV showed the second plane sail into the second tower. Back in Boston, Bob had come and started cleaning the kitchen as I brewed coffee. The radio reported a hit on the Pentagon. Sometime before or after that, my pupil Sergio rang from Lower Manhattan, where he was staying at his girlfriend's place before leaving to take up a post at the Hebrew University. He told me he was watching the first tower collapse. I wandered outside and went to an empty record store and bought the record, Dylan's record. At the cash register, I asked the sales girl if there was more news. She replied she was not American but Canadian and was planning to go home as soon as possible. "You Americans think you're invincible," she said smugly. "We are," I said, "but we're also vulnerable. Wait and see. We're going to win this war." Then I went to Harvard to check my emails, but they were all inane. I went home. I went for a swim. I ate dinner with a friend. That night I went out for a walk again, and it was a beautiful night just like the last one, but the streets were dead. Later on, the only planes in the sky were F-16s patrolling Boston in great arcs. I did not think they were locking the barn after the horses bolted. I did think every plane might be one of the enemies that had got through, so I'd get up and with my arms make a tent over my cat in case the building collapsed, so that she could be saved in an air pocket that way. I gave up sleeping and called an old teacher of mine in Paris. Friends called from Manchester and Petersburg. The above paragraphs about the sweet pre-war life and the terrible day come from my notebook. I rode on the Greyhound bus down to New York on Thursday. The highway was empty. Lines. The whole country, never cheerful, sunny, open again. All the fun over. All the safety of the ocean's gone. I'm dreading what's at the end of this road. It should be home, and most of home's there. We just passed Food and Books in Connecticut, the old pit stop where you get a free book with your sandwich. In the Lost City. The Port Authority bus terminal. On the subway uptown, people wan from crying or in shock. Everyone somber, exaggeratedly polite. I visit my parents, my brother, his wife, and their baby. I get home to Dennis. We drink some wine and recall sitting over a bottle on the corner where Boulevard Saint-Michel meets the Seine a few weeks before. I had a picture of it all in my head, but the picture makes no sense. Later on, we walk to the home of a friend, an Armenian who lived through years of civil war in Beirut. There's tea and pastry, comfort from someone who's been there. Late at night, my oldest friend Steve stops by. Usually he just munches leftover and growls. Tonight he's haunted, visibly aged. He's a computer programmer for a downtown firm and he was a few blocks away. Usually he got off the subway at the World Trade Center stop for a stroll to the office, but Tuesday he was late and got off down the line. Walking through the office, he heard noise, then saw a lot of black smoke billowing out of the first tower. They decided to go for the stairs down to the lobby, and the second plane hit soon thereafter. They went out. The police were telling people to go north, away, but he says many just stood there looking. As he reached Washington Square Park, the towers began to fall and people started running south for a better view. He would not turn around. He walked uptown, up to his parents, had a few whiskeys, got a ride home. A friend of his saw the second plane and the people falling. A friend of his girlfriend saw a falling body crush the woman next to her. Why did he not turn? The indecency of allowing evil to become a spectacle? Friday, September 14th. Early in the morning, I go down to Midtown, to my childhood dentist, who sends me a few blocks east for a root canal. I'm absurdly grateful that amidst this murder, there are gentle souls performing intricate operations to make people well on their teeth. A friend of a friend was near the towers where they fell and says she was pelted with a hail of teeth. Teeth? Teeth. As the Novocaine starts to wear off, I join the crowd in a foul rain outside St. Patrick's. All are quiet, immensely sad. Everyone shares his umbrella. The sermon. Of all the possible means of expression, the creator of the universe has chosen to communicate with us through love. The recessional is America Beautiful. Outside, the rain still falling out of a filthy sky, we are breathing the smoke, a fine, endless, dusting ash made of thousands of incinerated people, 2-quarter-mile buildings, and everything in them. I walk downtown. I gingerly drink some strong coffee in a Soho cafe. The galleries are shut. People look broken. The chic and energy of this district a week ago is as dead as the pyramids? No, Egypt had a natural death. This is dead like the Jewish life of Warsaw or Krakow. This is not some other place, after all. This is New York. It's my world they have murdered. On the way downtown, I purchase a bunch of dill for soup for Arab Shabbat from a Tibetan on Union Square. 2 American flags from a black woman whose family are downtown and are not accounted for. On Lower Broadway near NYU, the Lubavitchers are waylaying people as usual to put on tefillin. They tell me Rosh Hashanah is the great chance to announce that God is the king of the world and to transform this world into light. But the truth is I went into the cathedral just to be with New Yorkers, that I wanted to chat with these insanely optimistic Hasidim. I don't care whether God chooses to talk to us by telegraph right now. It all ends at Canal Street. with an eerie barricade right across the island, where the Twin Towers were in the frozen zone. Weird billows of white smoke, completely silent crowds, lots of sirens and dump trucks. A fighter plane circles low overhead. It's still raining. I pull on the maroon hood of my Harvard sweatshirt, open my diary, unscrew a pen, standing on native ground amidst my family, gaze from Chelsea, displaced Tribecans, gallery owners, bond traders, Chinese peddlers, Hasidim, Mexicans with candied peanut trolleys, black guys, Columbia boys, lots of volunteers from everywhere, the invited ghosts of Washington, Whitman, Melville, and Emerson, the bodies and ashes falling endlessly with the rain, right. And this is what I wrote. The city is changed and sorrowful, and it is all unimaginably and horribly different. However, New Yorkers love it, and it turns out each other, and I find I love the city more than ever, and cannot tell you how proud of it I am, and of us, and how grateful to be in it now, where one has to be here after the unbearable loss. Here is nowhere else in the whole world. Here, Canal Street changed and grim. Here, where we strolled and ate dim sum. Here, where Dennis and I went to parties and lost in those electric, illuminated fall nights of our youth. Here, where the great towers rise, stranger and more glorious than Persepolis, though two are gone. Where the autumn is not gaudy and chic, but somber. Every face fighting back a tear. People staring as they walk. All these cars with flashing lights coming out of the frozen zone. The land of the lost. And the rest of us, from every country on earth, in this country made for all. The strangeness and sorrow of all this horrible, quiet aftermath and what is to come. After that, I walk back uptown, past the thousands of little posters of the missing people. The names were Indian, Korean, Chinese, English, Irish, Jewish, German, Italian. Often the pictures are in color, the man or woman at their wedding or on holiday or dressed for a business day with a smile. One guy is described as having a facial scar from a skin cancer and a titanium hip. A middle-aged man smiling in the picture with the war wounds of getting older on the job of living. Makeshift memorials and shrines everywhere, flags, flowers, inscriptions, pictures of the towers, a bumper sticker with two of them forming an inscription, "We will rise again." I get home. We drink. We cook for Shabbat. I read my chronicle, having a hard time with the part about the missing person posters. Sergio and Melina arrive. Sergio's been a relief volunteer since the attacks and looks very sad, but also very determined. I knew him when he was an ungainly freshman, and now he's grown up. It's our home, I keep saying, and at last I totally lose it. He keeps me from falling down. Somehow we eat dinner. I pass out, crying, vomiting, unconsciousness, the sense that less sunlight is reaching the earth than in August, the grainy ugliness every morning when a few minutes after waking, you remember the way the war has reached in and befouled our lives, though the night, if you slept, almost made you forget. Unless you dreamed of planes falling. When this war began, there were discordant notes. People asked, "Why do they hate us?" And the answer came back, U.S. support for Israel. The Christian Science Monitor suggests not that support for Israel is morally wrong, just that it's more trouble than it's worth. A student of mine wonders aloud to me that Israel might have been a mistake. Are other nations' errors provisional entities to be corrected by deletion? Bernard Wasserstein has written in the Chronicle of Higher Education of the knee-jerk anti-American enmity emerging in Europe as an extension of anti-Semitism, that venerable socialism of fools, warning Americans not to accord to our enemies the respect of considering their motive for wishing to murder us. But his is a lonely voice. The West is leaning over backward to prove to the Arabs that we're really nice. Please don't hate us. We feel for your grievances. Arik Sharon declares, "We aren't going to be Czechoslovakia." That is no appeasement and no passivity. Jews will not be the next sacrificial lamb. Fascism, now with a Muslim face, will not get that far this time. The Bush administration doesn't like the comparison, says so. Sharon backtracks, but just a little, and the penny drops. For the time being, Professor Samuel Huntington's theory of warring civilizational blocks, amongst which Islam is by far the most aggressive and violent, seems to me to be the most accurate description of our situation right now. It's a repellent vision, and surely one reason we must fight is to defeat the tyrannies that make it possible to observe the world and then think such a theory. Americans fought World War II with the stated aims of freeing people from fear and want, and the record of the years from 1945 down to 2001 suggests we've made progress. The movement of mankind towards freedom must not be halted by the present Islamic movement, a retrograde thing that offers no vision except superstition, repression, and destitution. Those who have turned the Islamic world into a mass of jihad are guiltiest before their own people, for there is an Islamic culture, part of world culture, and the relationship of mankind to it is irrevocable. Finally, there's a refrain to a song by John Mellencamp. Come on, baby, take a ride with me. I'm up from Indiana down to Tennessee. Everything's as cool as it can be in a peaceful world. This is the refrain. He plays it in a haunting acoustic version on a record that's been bestseller for weeks. It's now a week to Christmas after a fall term that seems to have lasted years. We were astonished by the people from Indiana and Tennessee and other states who came to Manhattan to help and give unstintingly. They came to see New York as their hometown. We were glad to show off for them. We're such a different country now. This land is your land, this land is my land, isn't hokey anymore. The friendly Harlequin-esque icon of the Stars and Stripes means many things to us. And in September 2001 in New York, it became a talisman people clung to in the grip of bewilderment when a familiar world was transformed. For me, the refrain of Mellencamp's song may be an emotional relic of those days that will endure, for I knew the special peaceful world of America and lived through the surrealistic suddenness of its loss, the new realities hellish. But my parents have been a lot tranquiller. They've been through more. On December 7th, 1941, the boy who would one day be my father was at the movies in Bath Beach in Brooklyn. The girl, my mom, whom he was not to meet for another 3.5 years, was a few miles away, also in Brooklyn. The house lights in the theater went on, and a man came on stage and told the audience of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. Everybody went home quietly. The next day, our president, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, addressed the nation. I imagine my parents sitting in their separate homes in front of sitting room radios the size of coffins shaped like cathedrals or church organs, but my mom says she heard the speech in assembly at school, and of course, December 8th was a Monday. No matter how long it may take us to overcome this premeditated aggression, the American people, in their righteous might, will win through to absolute victory. The wistfulness of the song, the flickers of FDR's fire, that's what it's like these early days and early years of World War III here in the United States of America. Thank you, and God bless you.
Thank you so much, Professor. The professor will take some questions.
Yeah, anyone? Back there? Could you speak a little louder? I can't hear you.
I'm curious as to what your response to the fact that fact that I know it's intense.
Okay. The question is that many people who call themselves liberal also consider themselves pro-Palestinian. And what would be the response? Well, there are a number. I guess, first of all, defining terms is very important. Yeah? Okay. Liberal, left wing. My grandfather was one of the founders of the American Communist Party. I'm bilingual in Russian because at the age of 15 I went to the Soviet Union and I still go to Russia every year to teach. I'm gay. I married my partner a year ago in Toronto. I'm all for feminism, integration. You know, my father was Martin Luther King's lawyer. I think that kind of gives me some sort of left-wing credentials. I still have them. And I think the best place, one of the best places in the world where you can be left-wing like that is Israel. Israel is the only country in the Near East which has gay rights. It's the only country in the Middle East where women have rights that are probably considerably stronger than in America. Women have advanced farther in many areas in Israel's society than America. When I was a teenager, I worked on a moshav on the border with Lebanon. And it came much closer to the socialist dream than anything I saw in the Soviet Union. I once went to a collective farm in the USSR. It was a citrus farm in the Republic of Georgia, in the Caucasus. And I couldn't get a lemon or an orange for the love of God. They said, "We're only a citrus farm in name. We don't grow anything." That was socialism in theory. Israel was like socialism in practice. Yeah? When, you know, Israel, the world changes, Israel is a little less socialist than it was, but it still has a safety net, all those other things. And since Israel was essentially forced to occupy the West Bank during the 1967 war, 5 universities have opened, Arabic universities, that didn't exist before 67. Yeah. The living standard of Arab citizens of Israel is very high. And there are Arabs in the Knesset. How many Jews still live in Iraq? Huh? Where are the Arab Jewish communities? I can ask this question because my grandfather was a Moroccan. It was a problem because my mom didn't speak Yiddish. And my dad, Ashkenazim, they used to call her the Kleine Schwarze. But, you know, so I'm half Sephardic. Yeah? And I know something about the conditions of Jewish life in the Near East. So all in all, if you really are a liberal, then you should support Israel. Because ultimately, Israel doesn't want to wage war against anyone, wants to be left alone. No? When I lived in Israel, I had Arab friends. I spoke a little of the language. I used to drink coffee with them. They didn't want to go to war with me either. No? The Palestinian movement is essentially a retrograde ideological force that wants to impose a kind of fascism on the Near East. Again, since I'm a professor of Armenian, I also speak Armenian. Jerusalem has an Armenian quarter. I had a friend, a young woman about your age, who lived in East Jerusalem in Beit Hanina, which is outside the old city, sort of northeast Jerusalem. And she told me that before the 67 war, A Muslim neighbor had said to her, as soon as we kill off all the Saturdays, meaning those who are Shomrei Shabbat, we're going to take care of the Sundays. See? So, I don't see very much in the Palestinian movement that's attractive. I find, not even for Palestinians. And it seems to me that when Israel makes concessions of the kind it has, these are misinterpreted as a sign of weakness. And living standards and conditions for the Palestinians have not improved as a result of these concessions either. And now the use of the word liberal. It's very important, I think, to keep in mind that terminology may stay the same, but the meaning of terms changes. And in periods of enormous social convulsion, the meanings of terms can flip 180 degrees. See? So that the positions of the extreme right of the 30s are very similar to those of liberal people who call themselves liberals now, at least with respect to the Near East. And the so-called neocons, the neoconservatives, are not only in many cases much closer to the liberals of old times, but actually come from families that did things that, like, fight the Spanish Civil War, or warn of the rise of Nazism, or try to get Jews out of occupied Europe, and all the rest of it. And classical liberals have been very strong supporters of Israel. The Reverend Martin Luther King was, and so were most others. So I would challenge the use of the word liberal, and then I would look at the precise aspects of the Palestinian movement and judge them on their merits, rather than judging a label. Please.
Thank you. Professor, your speech is quite moving, and the emphasis on public terrific. I wonder if you had any solutions to the problem that you spoke of today on campuses.
I was afraid someone would ask for this, because it's always the hardest question. Oh, I'm sorry, of course. The question is, and I'll rephrase it in a few words, in the words of Chernyshevsky and Lenin, what is to be done? Что делать? This is the accursed question that Russian liberals have asked themselves through the 19th century, and the more they asked, the worse the solutions were, actually, in Russia. But it's a good question to what should we do now?
Excuse me.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
It would be much easier
to talk into the microphone.
Talk into the mic.
You bet. Sorry. I'm not really the best person to answer the question because I'm not an activist. I've fallen into this because I felt I had to. It seemed to me part of one's responsibility. I think that not just the legitimacy of Israel, but the position of the Jewish American community is under threat in a very acute fashion right now. This is a critical time. And the narrative of Israel's culpability, of its responsibility for 9/11 itself, has become so much a part of the mainstream that if you open the pages of the New York Times book review, today, Sunday, I was reading it on the way down from Manhattan, there it is. There's a book that's just been published on El Qaeda and what to do about it by a colleague of mine at the Kennedy School, not Walt, a specialist on terrorism. And at the end of the review, the reviewer, who is the editor of United Press International, says, there's only one thing she neglected to mention, but it's the only thing that matters, and it's this. This terrorism is taking place because we support Israel. What I would do is challenge constantly the authors of such statements. Not by not by apology, not by retreat, not by saying, oh, well, it's not just because we support Israel. There are also other causes. Of course there are other causes. But to fall into that trap is to dignify the technique being used in the first place to delegitimize us as people. Yeah? No, you have to say, yes, 9/11 was because of Israel, in large part, because Israel is the bellwether of such things. Because the Jews tend to be accused first, because they're visible, because they can't be assimilated into a millenarian program. And then you go from there and say, okay, these people have grievances. They hate Israel. Yeah? Israel is a good society. Is a bad society. Let's go on. They're using terrorist means. What are their ends? Nobody seems to talk about this enough. One of the strong points of academic support for communism during the Cold War was that the communists ostensibly wanted to make the world a better place in which to live. Yeah? Free health care, Sputniks were flying around in the sky. The Soviet Union was very good at advertising such things. Yeah? What is it that Hamas wants? Yes? We now know that there is no real secular movement amongst the Palestinians, is there? It's Hamas. In Lebanon, it's Hezbollah. In Iran, for the time being, it's the extreme wing of the mullahs. What do they want to do? They want to create a caliphate. The caliphate will rule by Sharia law. What does that mean? It means that women won't have rights. They won't be allowed to drive cars or vote or, in some cases, go to school. It means that people will be stoned and decapitated. It means that everyone will be forced either to convert to Islam or to be relegated to inferior social status and to pay a punitive tax. All of this is clearly stated by the proponents of the world caliphate. Yeah? This is the end. That's part of the reason why nobody on any American campus talks about the means justifying the end. They only talk about the causes that explain the means. This is the logical slither. So you have to turn that around and argue it and keep arguing it and support Israel very, very strongly. Very strongly. Now, it's very dangerous to fall into the rhetorical trap of saying, yes, there are things wrong with Israel, yes, there's this, yes, there's that. No! Compared to any of the Near Eastern states, Israel is exemplary. Israel's treatment of minorities in particular is exemplary. So this is what one has to do. You have to go on the offensive instead of allowing yourself to be placed on the defensive, because with the defenses becomes harder. So this is part of an answer. Maybe from over there first. Yes? Yes. Thank you. Thank you.
I assume I'm a professor. I've been teaching for 1.5 weeks at that college. I have been tenured at a college in this city, and I taught there for 14 years, and I quit my tenured position because of anti-Semitism on the campus.
Really?
I'm talking about students, and in fact, primarily it is my faculty and the union that organized the faculty on that campus. And they used every means at their disposal, the computer system to distribute anti-Semitic messages. They brought in speakers. As you said, right after 9/11, why do they hate us? Well, it's because Israel is not sufficiently cosmopolitan.
Mm-hmm.
And all those things, I don't want to trade too much on your time. I'm now happy at my new job and find that I'm going to have to go slay the dragon again. We're going to have a professor of peace studies at Bryn Mawr College deliver a lecture at midnight school night Bloomberg stating that the cause of the conflict in the Middle East is that the Jews are seizing Zion. They're creating a new narrative by living in places that don't actually have genuine historical significance. They're creating historical significance anew by their moving into these regions.
Where?
I guess it's a big lie.
Mm-hmm.
Archaeology, I guess, doesn't play a role in this. So I feel really worried about where we're moving, not just in foreign affairs, but within the society that conspiracy theories are becoming more popular, and the big lie is taking a hold of liberal imagination.
Yes. This is something you hear, that Jews moved to Israel, to Palestine, arbitrarily. I don't allow, for example, I don't use in my writing the word Palestine, because it is a word referring to the Philistines, and it was used by the Romans as a derogatory term. Part of this has to involve convincing ourselves. I came to New York in February 92 from Jerusalem to receive my appointment at Harvard and then go back to Jerusalem again. And my 92-year-old grandmother, who was born in Salonika in Greece, who was dying, was living at my aunt's house in Bensonhurst in Brooklyn. She had forgotten by this point how to speak English. She only spoke Ladino. So she didn't remember me either. So my aunt said to her, this is your grandson, James, all this in Spanish, who is a professor in, and then she didn't use the Spanish words, she said Yerushalayim. Now my aunt has hardly ever been out of Brooklyn. She never studied Hebrew. She never read a history book. And yet, in the Ladino language, in the Spanish language, this 500-year-old dialect, the word for Jerusalem is Yerushalayim. How is that so if we didn't come from there? Yeah? She's not part of an academic project to falsify archaeological remains. You see? But no, the thing is that, as there's a saying, if people put a saddle on you long enough, you act like a horse, no? If people keep telling you that Israel isn't yours, that there's no historical connection, that the whole thing was a narrative invented in the context of 19th century nationalist irredentism, etc., 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 you begin to believe it yourself. See? So I realize this is something of a psychological answer rather than a practical one, but one has to understand within oneself what the truth is. That liberates you, as someone I think who lived in Israel said once. Yes, I believe, sir.
Yes, you had talked about your credentials as a professor of Iranian studies, and if I'm correct, if I'm pronouncing your name correctly, Tommy is in the United States. So I was wondering if you could comment on the situation in Iran and like what you know.
All right. The question is, what could I comment as someone who does Iranian studies about the visit of President Khatami to the U.S.? Today, Khatami is speaking at Harvard. I don't know what he's saying there, but I sent a student of mine to listen. After the Islamic Revolution in 1979, there was a tremendous wave of repression and murder that swept through Iranian society and drove millions of people into exile. In the late 90s, a reform movement gradually gathered strength in Iran, and in 1997, Khatami was elected president. This was a period of enormous hope for the Iranians. I was unable to travel there because I have a dossier with the Iranian secret police. The reason is that I helped Zoroastrians flee Iran during the worst years of the Islamic Revolution. Zoroastrians are people who adhere to a religion that existed in Iran before the Arabs conquered the country in the 7th century. Persian culture is essentially Zoroastrian. The Persian language is not Arabic, although they use the Arabic script. It's a language related to English. It's an Indo-European language. It's closest to the languages of India. And Zoroastrianism is in some respect similar to the Vedic Hinduism of ancient India. Anyway, in the early years of the Islamic Revolution, many Zoroastrians fled across the eastern deserts into Pakistan, and from there to India, and I was part of a network of people who helped them, and I got 50 people refugee status in the U.S. So the authorities didn't like this, but by the late 90s, Iran's own character was also being encouraged academically and otherwise, and by 2000 I was able to enter the country through the intervention of the Ayatollah of Shiraz, Mahalati, whose son was the charge d'affaires of Iran in Washington. And while I was there, everyone knew, whom I encountered, that I had been a professor at Hebrew University, that I was Jewish, that I'd worked with Zoroastrians, and all the rest of it. And for reasons that I don't quite understand, I was approached as though I were the ambassador of the Republic of Armenia. This is how people from the government found an excuse to come and talk. They would say, oh yes, you know, I was even introduced by the governor of Khorasan, which is the major eastern province, at a big gathering as Namayan Day Armenistan, the representative of Armenia. But they would talk. At this time, Khatami was saying, if there's a Middle East peace settlement, and remember, this was something that Clinton was working very hard on, yeah? We will recognize Israel. Maybe the statement wasn't very widely broadcast, but these things were being said, and when I was in a small town in central Iran called Yazd, the owner of an internet cafe asked me to paint my national flag, as various backpackers did, on the wall. So I said, oh, that's nice. I'll put a little stars and stripes, but not today, tomorrow, because that, too, isn't such a good idea. He said, that's not the flag I was thinking of. I said, you mean Armenia? I said, no, no, another one, a white and blue one. I said, you've got to be kidding. He said, no, I hate the mullahs. Everyone here does. I want you to paint an Israeli flag in my internet cafe. I said, the day that Iran resumes diplomatic relations with Israel, I promise you, I'll make a special trip here just to do it. So, this is what many Iranians were like, are like, and then the country endured a tragedy. Khatami wanted to be the Gorbachev of Iran. He wanted to be the reformer who would keep the place together, preserve some of the system, but basically change it radically. The problem is, Russia had already had a Gorbachev. The mullahs who control the Iranian regime aren't stupid, and they wanted to make sure there wouldn't be another Gorbachev. You see, so Khatami was forced out of power in a series of maneuvers. One of them was to get rid of the people around him who were the most radical in their desires for reform, for westernization. I knew, for example, the Minister of Culture, Mohajirani, who, when I met him, had survived two assassination attempts already by Hezbollah. Hezbollah is identical with the Revolutionary Guard. They call it Hezbollah there. Mohajirani, a week after I met him, was forced to resign. He was put on a show trial on TV in front of the Council of Islamic Guidance, Ershad Islami, and that was the end of that. And things gradually got tighter and tighter and tighter, and now there's President Ahmadinejad. If Khatami is in this country, it means that President Bush wants him here. He wouldn't have got an entry visa if Bush hadn't wanted him to get it. And I don't think that Condoleezza Rice is an enemy of the Bush administration. Yeah? I realize the State Department usually gets a bad rap because they represent the retrograde Arabists and all the rest, but in this particular case, I think that Bush wants Khatami here. At the risk of being seen as a barbarian or a dinosaur, I'll say I'm a very strong supporter of President Bush, and I think that if Khatami is an official guest of the United States, then we should listen very carefully to what he has to say, because there are probably good reasons for his having come. That's my view. We need to know as much as we possibly can, and we also have to be able to emphasize to the Iranian people that we are not anti-Persian, but that we are very interested in their having a government that comports itself in a civilized manner, see, as part of the world community. You know, and therefore, I think Khatami might have interesting things to say. If he turns out to be a propagandist, we're not fools, and we'll understand that too. So, thank you.
Thank you so much, Professor Russett, for your enlightening and inspirational remarks, and also for memorializing 9/11 in such a beautiful way for us. Thank you so much. Bob and the Middle East Forum, thank you for joining us today, for co-sponsoring, and thank you all for coming. I hope to see you again soon at the Gershwin Marsh.